Good morning. This is Talking Animals on WMNF. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest today is Patrice Jones, co-founder of Vine Sanctuary. Vine, in this case, being an acronym for Veganism is the Next Evolution. Vine Sanctuary is a 100-acre facility in Vermont. We're spotlighting this week while we celebrate Pride Month as part of WMNF's mission calendar, describing itself as the LGBTQ-run farmed animal sanctuary. So our conversation with Jones this morning on Talking Animals provides something of an overview of Vine, how it navigated various COVID challenges and more. We'll also aim to discuss what being an LGBTQ-led sanctuary means in key ways, how that ethos guides the Vine operation in ways that notably contrast with the operation of other farmed animal sanctuaries that Jones is familiar with, and so on. A scholar, writer, activist, and educator, Jones has authored numerous articles and essays and written or co-written multiple books. We'll delve into several aspects of Vine Sanctuary when I speak with Patrice Jones in a few moments here on Talking Animals on WMNF. Meanwhile, later in today's program, we'll hear a brief interview with Natalie Gill, campaign leader at Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, for a newly announced initiative to protect the dolphins of the Amazon River. Gil spoke with me from Brazil last night via Zoom about the campaign's objective, and its implications. We'll hear that conversation later in today's show. Right now, though, let's discuss the Vine Sanctuary with Patrice, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is Patrice Jones on Talking Animals on WMNF. Good morning, Patrice.
Good morning, Duncan. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for coming back. And again, we have spoken a few times on the show over the years, but for those who didn't hear those conversations, or somehow don't vividly remember every word of our scintillating conversations, so let's review some history. So, I mean, for starters, this place wasn't always focused on farmed animals, or even located in Vermont, for that matter. So kind of give us a little bit of the story of the evolution of the whole shebang.
Well, we have always been focused on farmed animals, but it was initially just chicken. The sanctuary was founded in 2000 when co-founder Miriam Jones and I found a chicken by the side of the road in the part of the country where factory farming of chickens was invented and perfected. We brought her home, and from that moment grew a sanctuary that for the first 9 years, say from 2000 to 2009, we were a refuge for chickens, literally surrounded by factory farms holding tens of thousands of chickens. That first bird, who we thought was a hen, turned out to be a rooster, and that led us to focus particularly on the problems that roosters face. So during those years, we became the very first sanctuary to figure out a protocol for rehabilitating roosters used in cockfighting so that they can live peacefully within flocks. In 2009, we wanted to expand in order to offer refuge to survivors of dairying, which as feminists we consider a feminist as well as an animal liberation issue. And there were not any farmed animal sanctuaries in Vermont, so we relocated here. And now more than 700 animals live here at the sanctuary, including 39 cows, hundreds of chickens, smaller numbers of goats, sheep, alpacas on the bird side, turkeys, ducks, geese, pigeons, two emus, and one exceptional pig.
All right, well, I got many things to ask you about, but right off the bat, I have to ask, what makes that pig so exceptional? Just that it's the only one, or some other things?
Yes, she is the only one, and is the second in a series of only one pigs. The very first pig who came here, we're not really set up for pigs,
okay.
But this was a pot-bellied pig who was deeply bonded to some guinea fowl and some chickens who we were taking in, and who we felt would be ill-served, having never lived with other pigs, to be separated from her friends and forced to go to a pig sanctuary instead. So we went ahead and just created a space for her here. She was elderly and eventually died. And then very shortly thereafter, in a backyard in New Hampshire, turned out to be an emu and a pig. Who knows how or why, because they were abandoned there. And so Val the pig came with her emu friend to Vine.
So I guess the second pig was sort of grandmothered in based on the other policy. Yeah.
Well, and we've now built a piggy palace for her. So we do intend to have... we're looking for a companion for her. So we do intend to have maybe two.
Okay.
These are not full-sized pigs. We're not set up for full-sized pigs.
Right. Sounds like it wouldn't expand much beyond that other than just having a nice friend for a pig, the current pig.
Yes, exactly.
Cool. So already you've kind of cited a number of sort of distinctive things about Vine. I mean, not least that it's pretty unusual for a sanctuary to pack up and move once it's been gone for a few years to not just a slightly different location, but to an entirely different state. So was it partly you mentioned that there really wasn't a sanctuary in Vermont? I can't remember if we talked about this before, but what drove that plan to relocate in that way, which seems enormously ambitious?
The initial property, remember, the sanctuary started accidentally and grew organically. So the property we were on for the initial sanctuary was not one that anyone would have chosen. We just made it work.
Just happened.
Definitely our ethos.
Just make
it work as not only veganly but freeganly as possible. So there were many issues, including a declining water table and the failing of the pump of the well in the region because of overpumping by the poultry industry. There were other sanctuaries offering refuge to chickens, both in Maryland and Virginia. So when we thought about relocating, we thought, well, why don't we go somewhere where we're really needed? And that turned out to be here.
I see. Great. And it's 100 acres, is that right?
Over 100 acres.
Yeah.
About more than half of which we reserve as wildlife refuge.
Oh, that's great. So that's always kind of earmarked for that purpose. And but still there's 700-plus animals there in the meantime enjoying the rest of the land.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
That's great. All right. So for now, at least that's the sanctuary story. We'll leave it there, but we'll obviously pick up that thread in a minute. But I think you'd like to hear a little bit more of the Patrice story at this point. Oh, well.
Okay. Fine.
Okay. Well, I could persuade you. It sounds like barely. But so some of this, again, is review. But where did you grow up?
I grew up in Baltimore City.
And what role did...
go ahead.
No. I was just going to say, and what role did animals play in your family when you were a kid?
You know, that's a good question. Actually, I was born in Baltimore City, but my father, at the time of my birth, was in the Navy, and so we did live at various naval bases during my first 3 or 4 years. And one really distinctive experience was that when we were in Newfoundland at the naval base there, the house that we were in functioned as a sort of de facto animal sanctuary. Or dog shelter, where if people were deployed out, the dog would go there, and then someone new would come in and adopt the dog. I was very young, so I don't know the details.
Yeah,
but I do know that I was sort of surrounded by dogs who were, compared to me, giant.
Yeah.
And that I always felt super safe in their company. My family was not safe. But I always felt very safe with the dogs around. And then when we moved to Baltimore permanently, or moved back to Baltimore where my grandparents lived, there were always dogs.
I see. So dogs were a through line. But just back up for a sec, Patrice. As far as the house on the base, so it was your family's house? Because, I mean, it sounds interesting if I follow you that it's like, hey, come right in. Here's your house now that you've moved to the base. By the way, there's a dog sanctuary here. I hope that doesn't inconvenience you in any way.
I have no idea.
Okay.
I didn't even really know this until I just had memories of being, you know, very small, surrounded by lots of dogs.
Okay.
And I didn't even learn the details of it until I was adult and I've never really known exactly how.
Yeah, it sounds like family lore of some kind that's a little fuzzy maybe. but it is interesting. So let me just let folks know who might just be tuning in. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you did just tune in, my guest is Patrice Jones, co-founder of the Vine Sanctuary. Vine is an acronym for Veganism is the Next Evolution. It's a 100-acre facility thereabouts in Vermont. We're spotlighting as we celebrate Pride Month as part of WNS Mission Calendar. Vine is described as an LGBTQ-run farmed animal sanctuary. If you'd like to ask Patrice a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. So go ahead.
If you're interested in the sort of the formative experiences, I would say, you know, for me, I remember very clearly as a child having an experience where someone on our block had shouted at all the other children to get off our property. And so then I went up. We lived in a little row house in Baltimore City. And so then I went, and I was out front of our house. And I had 1 foot on the public sidewalk and 1 foot on our little tiny yard. And I was going back and forth from 1 foot to the other foot, saying, our property, not our property. Our property, not our property. And I was trying to figure out how this could make any sense whatsoever. And my mind, my little childhood mind, flashed back to, you know, what I had learned about the pilgrims. And I imagined this pilgrim with a musket building a wall, which he then defended with a musket. And I thought to myself that it really didn't seem fair. That because he had a gun, like he could do that. And also, I remember specifically sort of seeing, as I was thinking this, a squirrel came into my field of view, and I thought, how could it be that like a human, like building a wall around something, could turn a tree or a squirrel into property? And so that insight has become more, you know, intellectually coherent.
Yeah, it was kind of a precocious thought to have at the time, right?
But, you know, that feeling of wrongness, that feeling that only that it's only by violence that the larger than human world, you know, is under the control of humans. Like in some way, I was aware of that. And it felt really wrong, and so you know, that insight has persisted. I did quit eating meat when I was 15. It took me shamefully longer than that to go vegan. But that was the same year that I also went to my first gay rights rally. And so then, for a significant period of my adult life, I was a vegetarian but not vegan. Who worked mostly or exclusively on what we would now call social justice issues, gay rights. I was in ACT UP, the AIDS organization. I was a tenant organizer. I worked at a center for anti-racist education. And through all of that, I wasn't eating animals. But I wasn't, even though I was really clear that all of the different ways that human beings hurt each other are interconnected. For whatever reason, I wasn't making the connection, and so the not eating animals really felt like a personal choice rather than a political choice, even though I was quite clear that everything is political. So, you know, I try to remember how I felt back then, because I think there are still a lot of people who feel that way and who can be and who will respond. At some point in my adult life, I began to understand both the extent and horrificness of all the things that humans do to non-human animals at pretty much the same time as I was discovering that I really couldn't understand the ways that humans hurt each other without reference to speciesism, which is foundational to various forms of social injustice, and so that's when I began to go vegan, and it was when Miriam and I were in the process of having that realization and going from vegetarian to vegan that we found the chicken.
Yeah, so it sounds like two or three at least notable storylines kind of start to intertwine. Activism, early activism, the early not eating meat, even though, as you say, it took a while to arrive at veganism, and then not coincidentally perhaps at all, that's when that significant bird turned up.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Wow. So, and I'm still pondering the image of the get off my land, or get off the property thing. So, I mean, that figures in there obviously somewhere too. But so, okay.
Yeah, it's really foundational. And it's important for us to understand too, because, you know, there are a lot of people within animal advocacy, you know, who still maybe feel that perhaps we can consume our way to animal liberation. And I'm not denigrating any of the efforts to make veganism more accessible, including through various products that are now possible. But I definitely see that as a step rather than a goal. And if we really understand the degree to which violence is at the heart of everything that humans do to animals, that we have to see that that's actually part of a violence that is also inherent in the conception of private property, in the turning of the larger than human world, land, trees, into objects that can be owned by humans. And I don't think we can solve animal exploitation without understanding and addressing that directly. I don't think we can solve the climate crisis either. It's really important for us to demote humans from their elevated, separate category into which we've installed ourselves and maintained ourselves by violence, and begin to understand ourselves as co-inhabitants of ecosystems upon which we entirely depend. We're not only are we not the bosses of the world, but in fact we're entirely dependent on the other than human world, right? We couldn't take a breath if it weren't for plants making oxygen.
Yeah. And Patrice, as you're talking about the violence, I mean, one of the things that obviously gets to people sometimes effectively, sometimes less so maybe, is glimpses, or more than glimpses, images of factory farming and the violence that does take place there. But I also think another way that, or another element that's missing, and that sanctuaries like yours and others, depending on to what extent they allow visitors, is that most people don't have an occasion to know a cow or know a chicken. And it does seem like when people go to a sanctuary that does allow those kind of visitors, there's something transformative that often happens there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that does. I think that we have to be a little bit careful with that analysis because, you know, of course, all the people who are killing cows know cows.
All
of the people who are killing chickens know chickens.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So it was
So we have to be. So that's one little caveat that I have there, and then the other one is the idea that you would have to know somebody.
Right. Yeah.
Like I would like our empathy with others who are different than ourselves to not be limited by who we've known personally.
Okay,
this is not to say that it's not a pragmatic, right?
Right.
And within the gay movement, we very much relied, especially starting in the 70s and 80s, we really relied on these going around telling our coming out stories to people just so that they would meet someone who was out and hear their story. And that was a key component. It was a key tactic. And so I'm not saying that it's not a useful thing to do, but I am saying that I would like us to evolve into people who don't need to know someone personally in order to care about them,
right,
or at least refrain from harming them.
Yeah. No, I think at this point I may largely withdraw that analysis, but what you do mention along the way, I think gets to something super important for today's conversation, because I just have a feeling we're never going to get to everything that I'm hoping to discuss with you today.
Yeah.
But as I did note, June is when we do celebrate Pride Month, and Vine described itself as an LGBTQ-run farmed animal sanctuary. So let's spend a few minutes talking about that. Let's start by asking you, maybe just to even expand on that phrase. I mean, what exactly does that mean, and what does that look like at Vine?
I mean, what it means is that Vine was started by two lesbians, and the preponderance of our staff are LGBTQ folks, but not all. And so for a long time it was all, and so then we had to figure out some phrase so that we didn't erase the couple of straight people who work here.
Mm.
And so we've sort of latched onto LGBTQ-led, just because the whole leadership team is queer at this point. We may need to shift words around as our staff evolves. I should mention also that the preponderance of our staff are people with disabilities, and we're really interested in the intersections between speciesism and ableism.
Mm.
But we do call ourselves the queer sanctuary, and we are we do differ from other sanctuaries pretty significantly. For those who are interested in following up, the authors of Zoopolis, Sue Donaldson and Will Klimica, have written a number of articles based on their researches into the different models of farm animal sanctuary.
Mm. And in the meantime, can you just give at least a few observations about what people might see at Vine that would be different than they would see at another farmed animal sanctuary?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So we really think of ourselves as a multi-species community, and we really strive and we recognize conscious the role of our non-human community members in co-creating the sanctuary. This is not to avoid knowing that because of the current political and social system that, unfortunately, to the wider world, the animals here at the sanctuary are our property. To the wider world, we own this land. We do have to circumscribe freedom at times, either to keep cows from wandering into woods where someone would shoot them, or to preserve safety or health in some other way. But we don't imagine ourselves as these. We try to challenge our own speciesism, which is really deeply embedded in people. And so, when it comes to other animals, humans just have this instinctive belief that they know better. And this often gets reflected in language, where non-human animals, even if they are elders, are referred to as boys or girls. And so we make a really conscious effort to recognize all of the adult animals at the sanctuary as our peers, and in some cases our elders. And we recognize that they may know more than we do. And we do everything that we can to foster self-determination and freedom, intervening only when it's necessary for the preservation of health or safety for somebody. We don't segregate animals by species. There are some areas that are just birds, and there's one big back pasture in which the hardiest cows conduct their own affairs, although they have plenty of wild friends who are not cows. But then there's the largest and most central area of the sanctuary, some people refer to as the commons, and there are cows, and literally everyone I listed earlier,
mm-hmm,
are there together, figuring out how to live together despite ginormous morphological differences, you know, giant cows small hens. And visitors who have come as scholars to study have remarked upon the ethos of care that infuses the sanctuary itself, in that animals of different species are clearly taking care to get along with each other and often extending care to one another. You might see cows grooming goat. You might see Domino, the neuroatypical alpaca, who is our welcomer of anyone who comes in and maybe is not going to fit in. He will befriend that person. Val the pig, when she came, had never lived with anybody other than an emu and was completely freaked out. Domino befriended her for a month. He was the only person she would allow to touch her. I guess that's just a glimpse of what you'll see. Most people who visit, I should mention about the visiting. So most people who visit, even if they've been to many other sanctuaries, remark that Vine is not like any place they've ever been on Earth. I would say that because of our political commitments, and also because, you know, some of our sanctuary residents are themselves survivors of petting zoos, we're keen to avoid anything that would be like a petting zoo, and that for us that includes tours where people just walk around and look. Even if people are talking to them as they're doing that, we don't feel comfortable putting animals on display in that way. But what we do instead, because it can be really meaningful for people to participate in a multi-species community like this. So how we do our public days is people come in and they have to actually add their own muscular labor. They come and they volunteer for a couple hours while they're actually, you know, painting the coop, and so all the birds are around, or they're pulling up thistles in the pasture, and so cows and sheep are around, and after they've spent some time actually becoming part of our community by adding their labor to our community, then they get a tour.
I see. So it's far from the passive, let's wander around and look at this cow or this pig or whatever. Yeah. It's like, hey, this coop, this enclosure needs some work, and you'll do that first, and then we'll get to know them a bit more after that. After you punch your card, your time clock.
Well, you know, it's not so much the punching
card. No, I'm just kidding.
As it is actually
having an engagement, really, right?
Yeah, we think of a sanctuary as a place that's co-created by all of its participants. And so if you come here, you'll actually become part of the sanctuary. And leave a little bit of yourself behind in that work that you did.
Yeah.
And you'll always be part of the sanctuary rather than having been a separate passive spectator.
Right.
And that's really important because humans are used to thinking of themselves as like separate from everything.
Right. And you obviously that's going to foster a more profound connection with those animals wherever you did work on
that. We believe. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we don't denigrate sanctuaries who do things otherwise. There are many different ways to try and do what we're doing, and no one knows, you know, what is right.
So sure.
I'm sort of explaining our reasoning for how we do it.
Gotcha. Again, this is Talking Animals of Duncan Strauss. My guest is Patrice Jones, co-founder of the Vine Sanctuary. Vine standing here for Veganism is the Next Evolution. Vine is located in Vermont, and as we're hearing about, describes itself as an LGBTQ-run farm sanctuary, and seeing how that works and what might distinguish it from other farm sanctuaries you've heard about or even been to. And we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0800. 885. So I want to get into a couple other things shortly, Patrice, but I'm just curious, over the years with having all the animals, or not really segregating them generally, at least by species, were there things that you saw and learned? I mean, apart from like Domino being obviously kind of a social director of sorts, but were there other behaviors that unfolded that with the way that you had the animals housed that shaped further how you housed them? Like,
Absolutely. Look, when Miriam Jones and I first started what was initially a chicken sanctuary, we thought really hard about, you know, what we would want, what we wanted to do, what would be the right thing to do. And we decided that our motto would be, let birds be birds. In other words, that we would recognize that chicken are genetically almost indistinguishable from the wild jungle fowl of South Asia, from whom all modern chicken's descent. And that just like dogs, what they need more than anything is other dogs. Mm-hmm. That, you know, birds need other birds and bird trees and birds need brush and that we would give them, that our role would be to set up the circumstance in which they could become their bird self and forge flocks and have relationships with each other and do the things that birds want to do and pursue the projects that birds want to pursue. And that we, that our role would be to sort of create the situation in which that could evolve. And that we would be delighted, that we would be sincerely happy if some of them wanted to be friends with us too.
Mm-hmm.
But that we would make no effort to tame anyone.
Yeah.
That we would make no effort to foreground relationships with humans, that we would stay in the background as much as possible. And so that's what we did, and we carried that ethos over when we expanded to start to let cows be cows, mm-hmm. let goats be goats.
Yeah.
And of course, then we're observing the whole time. So I mentioned earlier the that we became the first sanctuary to figure out a method of rehabilitating roosters using cockfighting.
Yeah.
That could not possibly have happened were it not for the circumstance in which literally two dozen roosters who had been living together in another state, having been seized over the years by a humane officer who had nowhere else to place them and just kept taking them home, and then lost her land. So they came to us, and they'd all been living together and sleeping in the trees and going into an open barn when the weather was bad. And then they moved in with us.
Mm.
And these included many quite elder roosters. And so by observing them, we were able to see how it is that roosters maintain the peace among themselves in a healthy flock. And then we were able to conceptualize what it would be that roosters used in cockfighting who are raised in isolation and never learn the social signals that other roosters use to resolve conflicts, what they would need in order to become able to live in flocks as these wonderful birds were already doing. And so they are clearly, in my mind, the co-creator of that method, even though, like, I'm credited with, because I couldn't possibly have figured that out without knowing them and observing them. And then the process itself involves putting new roosters in a situation where they can observe the roosters who are already at the sanctuary getting along and learn by observation those behaviors, which they couldn't possibly learn from a human.
No, it seems like there's really a running theme of whereas other experiences or other places they might have behaviors that are kind of suppressed or forced in some ways. This is allowing them to relax, to express their more natural behaviors to the extent they can, and then see what happens from there as birds become birds or are allowed to be birds.
Right. But some process oftentimes, just as with humans, right? Some of us who have had, whether we've had social isolation or neglectful situations where we didn't have the opportunity to learn the social skills you need to get along in the world, or perhaps we have early trauma in our lives.
Yeah.
And so then we don't quite know how to act. And sometimes we act badly. So I'm not saying that's never true. That's often true.
Sure.
Folks are coming to us from, really horrific situations. But what's lovely at this point is, you know, we have this stable Pacific community, or in the case of some of the birds, there are several flocks, so communities, in which folks have figured out how to get along together. And so when new folks come, you know, they learn more from the other non-human animals, I think, than they do from us.
Yeah.
I mean, over time, they certainly do learn to trust us more than they trust other humans. But we don't really make a big deal out of that, because how they feel about humans is really not the most important thing in their lives. You know, what's important is, are they able to have self-selected relationships, either within their own species or, like us, many animals enjoy cross-species friendships.
Yeah.
Do they have the opportunity to pursue their own projects? But what I've noticed is Domino, I just selected as one. He's not the only non-human community member who plays a really important role in socializing new members. Among the cows, there's Rose, who's been here many, many, many years, but came originally after a long stint at a dairy.
Mm.
And And she and Autumn came together. And Autumn is sort of the matriarch of the special needs herd, so she's sort of the rule enforcer. But Rose is sort of like the emotional leader. And so oftentimes if someone new is here, you'll see Rose go over to them. And I want to use all these metaphors that aren't suitable for cows, like lend a helping hand or put them under her wing.
Yeah.
But what she's doing is offering, it's quite clear that what she's doing is offering empathy and care, mm-hmm. but also some instruction, like here's how we do things here.
Yeah, let me show you the ropes. Yeah.
And so there are, you know, in each of the different herds or flocks, there are individuals who have taken on various leadership roles. And we really recognize that while the humans are getting all the credit, really they are the co-creators of this community, which couldn't be what it is without their labor and love.
Yeah, let me ask you this then, Patrice, in light of what you're describing there. When the pandemic forced all kinds of restrictions on all kinds of places and people, how did that affect or maybe hamper, if it did, Vine and the animals in the way that you're otherwise describing now?
I mean, we were pretty lucky in that Vermont was, for the most of the pandemic, the safest state in the entire United States, with a smart and effective state government and low rates, et cetera. Cooperative people for the most part. Of course, like everyone else, we had some longstanding donors who lost their jobs and had to refrain from supporting us anymore. But we also had some donors who realized that we were going through that, and so they gave a little more, and it all sort of just balanced out. We've been chronically underfunded, in part because of being, I think, an LGBTQ-led organization that does things a little differently. So we're still chronically underfunded. What we're underfunded at about the same level we were underfunded. We didn't get even worse underfunded during the pandemic. But what we did realize was that on the site of the sanctuary itself, and you don't need to, I mean, there was all sorts of drama with the feed store shutting down and having to buy months worth of food and find places to store it, and the great sunflower seed shortage that lasted for months.
Oh, wow.
For the most part, you know, those were just stresses that the humans here were dealing with. I was worrying about the money. Cheryl was worrying about where we're going to find black oil sunflower seeds. For the most part, on site at the sanctuary, life proceeded as normal. And so we actually decided that what our job needed to be was extend that care outward to people for whom the pandemic was creating all sorts of stress and grief. So when the lockdowns first started, we went into a period that lasted for a couple months where we were doing daily live stream, which we normally don't do, just to give people an opportunity to tune in to the larger-than-human world, to see animals just on a regular Monday, and to soothe their stress a little bit. Mm-hmm. We also did more email newsletters than we would normally do. We did daily ones for a while, but that was not sustainable.
Yeah.
Cheryl, the head of our animal care team, sewed, I don't even know how many hundreds of masks, which we then mailed out to people doing vegan food relief in Baltimore and in New York City and some other places. We sewed masks that were given out at our public library. So that's pretty much how we handled the pandemic. Oh, and then we did move. The one thing that was an innovation that will stay is that we did find that suddenly our efforts to do online educational programming, which we've been trying to do for years without people really being interested or tuning in, now everybody knows how to use Zoom.
Yeah.
We did like three or four times the number of events we would normally do in a year in 2020, and many of them are things that we are continuing. So we started an online book club that now continues and will continue. I do an online support group for staff at other sanctuaries that continues.
That's great.
And our humane education, we always offered it online, but there weren't that many schools or libraries that tuned in. But But now we have, we're doing humane ed for an elementary school in New Zealand.
And wow.
Having a virtual field trip for kids in Chicago. it's just...
It's all online now, big time. It's everybody's really embraced it. Now. Yeah.
Right. So we've really embraced that, and that's going to continue.
So speaking of online, sorry, Preach, I didn't mean to jump in, but we're almost at the end of our time.
Sure,
and there was
sure.
One of the emails that came in I did want to read. It's a little bit long, but I think this might be perhaps the final word or close to it of today's conversation.
Okay.
But it says, I'm a proud supporter of Vine Sanctuary, meeting Patrice at an animal rights conference opened my eyes to the intersectionality of speciesism, sexism, and racism, all the isms. I know of no harder working sanctuary. Animals at Vine live their lives as intended and create family and friends with other species. Vine residents are loved and cared for beyond measure. Vine's way of operating and their message is critical to the survival of all sentient beings, two legs and four, fur, fin, feathers, or skin. Hearing Patrice is always enlightening, and I appreciate your having her as a guest. I hope your other listeners will read about Vine, check out their live streams, and consider ways to support their work. That's from P. Elizabeth Anderson. So that says, I think, quite a bit. And if we weren't at the end of our time, we would talk about outreach and beyond what you've talked about in terms of online.
For outreach, can I just say that we are doing a Pride Month vegan challenge, and it's not too late to sign yourself up or to sign a friend up. And you can just go to rainbowvegan.org to sign up to eat the rainbow.
Wow. I like it. Well, what we otherwise would have talked about, and we will next time, is the speaking that you do at conferences and elsewhere, which is a whole other fantastic and fascinating topic, but we've kind of reached the end of our time for today. So, Patrice, thank you so much. We've been speaking with Patrice Jones from Vine. Again, Acronym for Veganism is the Next Evolution. Vine Sanctuary, I think, is among the websites, right? That's still the current website.
Yeah,
I guess the new one's under construction.
VineSanctuary.org.
Right.
Or rainbowvegan.org.
Right. Cool. All right, Patrice, thank you so much, and we'll speak to you again soon, and thanks for joining us once again on Talking Animals.
Thank you, Duncan.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. In a moment, we'll hear from Natalie Gill, who lives and works in Brazil at the behest of Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, and in an interview recorded last night, she explains a new Sea Shepherd campaign announced a few days ago that's designed to protect the river dolphins of the Amazon River and help their population rebound. Right now, though, we're going to step into the comedy corner with a farm-related piece in a nod to our conversation we just completed with Patrice Jones. This, in fact, is part of a piece called Farming 101 by Drew Hastings in today's comedy corner. On Talking Animals on WMNF.
I lived out there for a month before I figured out that red stick on my mailbox wasn't a country 911 system. It is not easy. I'm going to make it work. I don't give up. Livestock, that's my dream. Livestock, man. But I'll tell you what, people think it's easy. You read up on it and it's... No, uh-uh. My first deal, I got ripped off. I bought a herd of Black Angus hogs, right? I thought they looked short coming off the truck. Pygmy cattle my ass. I've tried growing crops, but you'd find more cornrows on an NFL team than I could pull off my land. So I called Mr. Grimes. He's the county ag agent for my county, you know, like the Mr. Kimball dude, right? And I call him. He comes out, you know, takes soil samples, talks to me extensively about my background. Well, he tells me the best thing for me to plant is a for sale sign in the front yard.
That was Drew Hastings in today's Comedy Corner with part of a piece called Farming 101, taken from his album Irked and Miffed. Now it's time to hear my brief conversation with Natalie Gill about the new Sea Shepherd campaign, which aims to protect the river dolphins of the Amazon. Speaking from Brazil via Zoom last night, this is Natalie Gill on Talking Animals on WMNF.
Thanks for joining us on the show, Natalie.
Thank you, Duncan.
Yeah, thanks for joining us from Brazil, more to the point. How long have you been in Brazil?
Well, I am Brazilian, actually.
Ah, okay, so a native.
Yes, I am. Yeah,
okay, great. And what sort of presence does Sea Shepherd have there in Brazil?
Well, Brazil is one of the chapters of Sea Shepherd. It has some activities, some cleanup activities and educational activities on shore, such as what you see in France, in Australia, Germany, and so on. And yeah, now we're about to embark into a campaign together with Sea Shepherd Global. It's the first one that is happening in Brazil. So it's getting a little bit more important, let's see, for the, let's say, for the global Sea Shepherd movement. Yeah.
Sure. So tell me about this new campaign. It was just announced 2-3 days ago, I guess, by Captain Watson. Tell us a little bit about it and how it works.
So yeah, we have two species of river dolphins here in Brazil, which are quite iconic, the Amazon River dolphin and the Turkushi dolphin. And both of them were recently considered by the IUCN as threatened for extinction. And we are partnering with the Research Institute, the National Institute of Research of Amazonia, who said to us that actually they should be considered critically endangered by the way things look at their research. Actually, mm-hmm. they show that these two species, they halve by every decade. So what's needed for us to protect those two species is to gather more data and to partner on a long-term scientific expedition that calculated populations of those two dolphins in many points of the Amazon River.
And Natalie, tell me, what are the key struggles that these river dolphins face where their population is dwindling in such dramatic fashion?
Yeah, this is actually, unfortunately, a reality for all river dolphins around the world. And here in Brazil, it's not different. All of them are on the endangered list, by the way. And here in Brazil, their threat is mostly, well, what we call bycatch. So it's really common for fishermen to catch them on their netting, net techniques for fishing. Also, they are killed just as pests as well, because they compete for the fish with the local fishermen. Some other threats, such as dams, which is, you know, in Brazil, it's really predominant, and that separates the populations and could, you know, the isolation could cause also extinction of that isolated population. But recently, I mean, relatively recently, in the last 20 years, there is behavior that it's getting more common, which is killing the both river dolphins for bait for a type of fishing of a piracatinga fish, which is a kind of a scavenger fish here in Brazil, which is actually illegal to do. Of course, the hunting of those dolphins are illegal to be done, and also the fishing of the piracatinga is illegal for 5 years now.
Wow.
Unfortunately, we are in a moment of, and actually that moratorium happened because of the detection of this behavior. But this moratorium is lasting until July this year. So yeah, things are going to get worse.
Wow.
If this doesn't continue. So yeah, we are coming to this expedition at the right moment in time, I guess.
Yeah. Boy, it sounds like these nice dolphins are up against all kinds of complicated
and dangerous forces.
Yeah. So that's really tough. So what will we have just a moment or so left, probably, Natalie, but if the expedition goes as hoped, what will that look like for the dolphins?
Yes. Yeah, so if we actually detect that the reality we learned from one point of the river is happening in many points of the river, it means that those two species need to have much more severe protection, right? And of course, fiscalization. I think that's the most important thing. So by having a study that proves that they are critically endangered, our hope is that that causes a commotion for the local government and, of course, all the regulatory bodies here to help conserve and preserve them more, and you know, and stop all those threats I've been mentioning about. Yeah, that's our hope.
I see. So really the expedition and the research related to that will hopefully call attention in a way that the local officials can't really ignore, and will kind of force their hand ideally to take some action, put in some legislation or regulations, etc., to protect these dolphins.
Absolutely. And I think just the fact that we are expanding this conversation to the world, I think that's important in itself. So, yeah. You know, raising the, nobody knows about that outside Brazil. Nobody knows, actually, a lot of people don't know inside Brazil that this is happening. So it's very important that we raise the conversation. I think we are, just by starting the research, we're already having some impact for sure for those two dolphins.
And that's great. And along those lines, Natalie, where might people find either a website or social media pages where they could find out more about this campaign and about these dolphins?
Absolutely. So they can find on Sea Shepherd website, seashepherd.org. We have also the Brazilian website, seashepherd.org.br. Both of them have more information about the campaign. You can contribute with your donations. They are actually essential for us to continue the expeditions for the long term. Otherwise, we won't have all the research needed so we can prove they are, you know, in critical danger.
Right. Okay, Natalie. Well, gosh, thank you so much for sharing this important information. We'll keep a good thought about the expedition and the outcome that you were hoping for. And we'll keep tabs on things through social media and online as well in the meantime.
Absolutely, Duncan. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you. Bye-bye now.
All right. My thanks to Natalie Gill for joining us on Talking Animals, filling in on the whole situation with the river dolphins in the Amazon and the new campaign to help protect them and beef up their population. So we have just about reached the end of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Public Affairs continues at 11 o'clock and again at noon, and then music kicks back in at 1 o'clock. I'll be back next Wednesday with another edition of Talking Animals. Meanwhile, you can check out social media links, all kinds of other information, all our past shows at talkinganimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weeki, Wachee, and beyond. NPR News is next.